The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. The Scream by Brian Stableford. Paul Scrivener moved his knight to imperil Jim Alvey's rook, and then sat back in its chair so that he could watch the frown of concentration deepen on the sheriff's face. For half an hour now he had been patiently building a kingside attack, drawing a ligature around the beleaguered black pieces and squeezing the potential out of them. Alvey had defended as stoutly and as patiently as he usually did, but he could see that the writing was on the wall unless he could identify some cunning ploy that might free his pieces and turn the tide. They had been playing regularly for more than 4 years now. Scrivener won 3 games out of 5 and was glad that it wasn't more. All the pleasure went out of the game when it was too one-sided. There wasn't that much pleasure left in life these days, and he was anxious to conserve all that he could. While he studied Alvey's clouded expression, further confused by the yellow lamplight, which shone down at an angle, Scribner fanned his own face with a palm leaf. It was a hot night, and the humidity always seemed worse in the evenings than it did in the blaze of noon. Every year the swamp line crept closer. Every year the river floods were worse. When he had moved into the house 9 years before, it had seemed high enough on the hill to be safe for half a century. But now it no longer seemed such a secure haven. There was little or no chance of his being flooded out, but the spreading jungle weed and the insects it brought with it weren't just a threat to the gardens and the vegetable patches of the neighborhood. They were a threat to its whole way of life. Had the county not been devastated by a plague war and its population reduced from 30,000 to 6.5, a mass migration would already have begun. But the war had changed the attitude of the survivors very dramatically. A social solidarity and a stubborn determination had been created which must have been far closer to the spirit of the pioneers of 5 centuries before than to the competitive individualism of their 20th century grandparents. To the people who remained, the runway greenhouse effect was just one more aspect of the ongoing crisis, one more weapon of the war between Dixie and the devil, against which all possible material and spiritual resistance must be mounted. Alvey looked up without having played, taking a rest from the effort of concentration. "Hot as hell tonight, Doc," he remarked, watching the rhythmic movement of Scrivener's makeshift fan. "It's not so bad," said Scrivener laconically. "It's just the sweat of the swamp makes it seem so. It'll get better. Competition and natural selection will make the weed grow taller, pushing the canopy higher and higher. Eventually, the foliage will make a screen under which the likes of you and I can walk in relative comfort. It's already happening downriver. That's the whole idea of induced tachytele. It's evolution while you wait. You and I won't see the climax community of the weed kin, but Roy and his kids will." Roy was Alvey's son. In time, Roy would probably become sheriff, following in Jim's footsteps, just as Jim had followed in Joe's. The Alveys had always had the kind of stubborn regard for tradition that the whole community had recently recovered. The Elves were a much-respected family nowadays. They will if in the Skeeters don't get 'em, Alvey agreed. Pity you guys couldn't just make the trees without all the vermin come with 'em. Alvey's you guys meant scientists in general, not even genetic engineers in particular. Alvey would have said the same if Scrivener had been a physicist or a geologist, and there was no point Scrivener pointing out that he had only ever worked with human beings. These days, in Romilly, and a thousand small towns like it, all scientists were culpable, and all were expected to take responsibility for one another. We didn't make the Weedkin, Scrivener said mildly. We just made it easier for the Weedkin and the other green redeemers to remake themselves. We gave them increased plasticity and increased capacity to cope with mutation. They have to find their own ways to thrive in adverse circumstances, just as we do. Scrivener's we meant people, not just you and me. Alvey understood that. He was an intelligent man, in spite of the hick act he sometimes put on for Scrivener's benefit. The sheriff was just about to drop his gaze to the chessboard again when the scream split the night. The nodding head snapped upright, and Alvey looked straight into Scrivener's eyes for one painful instant before he jerked to his feet and looked wildly out into the night, trying to figure out the exact direction from which the sound had come. It was that kind of scream, the kind of sound which made a puppet of a man, jerking him around by his reflexes. The night was far too hot for his blood to run cold, but Scrivener felt a numbing terror clutch at his heart, as though it were trying to tear him in two. There was only one scream, then nothing. It lasted for maybe 2 seconds, and died abruptly, without fading as to a sob or a sigh. It was a scream like a stroke of lightning, or a bullet in the back, an explosion of agony which expanded all its energy in an instant. Scrivener watched the sheriff reach for his holstered gun, then hesitate and twitch his fingers impotently. Beyond the lamp-lit veranda, the night was black. There was nothing to be seen. The scream had sounded less than a quarter mile away, but not so close as to be on Scrivener's property. "What the hell was that?" whispered Alvey. "He's hoping it was an animal," Scrivener thought, surprised by his capacity for clinical analysis. "He knows that it wasn't, but he won't admit to himself that he knows. He doesn't want it to be human. He'd far rather think that nothing on earth could wring that sound from a human throat. That's what the other people will decide, that it was just some animal hollering. Nothing to be scared of." Aloud, he said, "I don't know." It was a very easy lie to tell. It wouldn't have been any easier to say the words if they'd been true. Scrivener wished that he didn't know, wished that he dared doubt, but he didn't. He'd always known, deep down, that he'd hear the sound again. He always known that there was no hiding place, that retirement and flight to the deep south weren't enough to hide him from the consequences of his error. A weird temporal echo allowed him to hear himself speak the words that he'd said only a few moments before to Jim Alvey. "We didn't make the weed kin. We just made it easier for the weed kin and the other green redeemers to remake themselves." He hadn't made the cause of the scream, but he'd made it possible for the cause of the scream to remake herself. "Whatever it is," said Alvey, "it's likely to be my business. Sorry, Doc, I can't finish the game. Leastways, not right now." "That's okay, Jim," said Scrivener, wishing that he didn't sound quite so calm. "We'll call it a draw. We'll start over some other night." Alvey looked down at the table at the paralyzed black pieces which he couldn't have freed, barring some miracle of inspiration, but he didn't protest. "You could set it up on your machine," he said, picking up his hat and straightening his pants. "Play it out against the program. It'd be a real tough test for the Silicon Grandmaster." He didn't mean it. Neither he nor Scrivener ever played against computer programs. They both thought chess, like all games, ought to be a matter of man against man. Best of luck, Jim, said Scrivener, wishing that he dared mean it. I hope it turns out to be nothing. Yeah, said the sheriff, as he jumped down from the veranda and strode away into the darkness. He gave the strong impression that he wished he dared mean it, too. Scrivener checked the water meter and figured that he could take a brief cold shower. Afterward, he dressed for bed. He thought that it was best to wear light pajamas in spite of the heat, to keep the flesh of his thighs from sweating too much when his legs rested together. He kept a single sheet on the bed, just in case something got inside the mosquito netting. There was no way you could keep the insects entirely at bay. But you had to minimize the problem. The rapidly proliferating new insect species weren't carrying anything particularly nasty. Induced Hecatelli hadn't yet succeeded in generating Son of Malaria, but their bites itched, and there was always the possibility of an allergic reaction. He tried to go to sleep, but he couldn't. The scream didn't echo in his mind, not at any rate as the ghost of a sound, but the possibilities awakened by the memory wouldn't lie quietly. He had found it increasingly difficult to sleep for 8 hours a night, or even for 5, since he had turned 60. It didn't require much disturbance of his mental equilibrium to deliver him into the untender care of Morpheus's dark sister, Insomnia. He tried to tell himself that he wasn't at fault. The fact that the road to hell was paved with good intentions couldn't allow people to give up on their good intentions. In an era when desperation licensed such wild cards as the Tacitelic Weedkin, his project had seemed like something carefully planned, something wholly controllable, something cleverly virtuous. It hadn't seemed like a crazy gamble, but Scrivener had seen the shock in Jim Alvey's startled eyes when the scream had lanced through the sheriff's train of thought. And he knew what kind of horror would overcome those same oddly mild and gentle eyes if Alvey ever found out what had caused it. Not that Alvey ever would, of course, when, probably by dawn's early light, one of Alvey's men eventually found the body. There would be nothing at all to provide a casual link between the death and the scream. It would be a conundrum as unyielding as the problematic position which the sheriff had gratefully abandoned in order to go about his business. Even so, it was impossible for Scrivener to convince himself that he wasn't responsible, that it wasn't his fault. In the long run, he thought, it'll all be okay. People will come through. The ecosphere will pull through because of us, the scientists. We provide the means by which society and wilderness alike may heal themselves. Without us, the world would be damned. In the long run, it'll be okay, and the pain, which the whole bloody world is screaming, will go away. In the meantime, there's nothing much that can be added or taken away from the world's pain by one man's endeavors or one man's mistakes. It's just a drop in the phone rang. Without having been quite aware of the fact, Scrivener had been waiting for it to ring. The scream hadn't just been a scream. It was a message, a threat, a promise. He picked up the phone and said, "Hello," as noncommittally as he could. "Did you hear?" she said rhetorically. She had made certain that he would hear. How long had she been out there in the darkness, lying in wait? "Did you understand?" "Martha," he said awkwardly. "Don't do this, Martha." It wasn't clear enough, he knew. He wasn't able to say precisely what he meant by this, and that would allow her to misunderstand.
"It's in the nature of a scorpion to sting," she said. "There's no use in asking it to show civilized restraint of its own accord. You have to handle it right. You have to give it a reason to live and not to sting."
"You're not a scorpion, Martha. You're a human being. You're not a prisoner of some blind, unreasoning instinct. You don't have to do this."
"You don't understand, Paul," she said softly but quite distinctly. "You don't understand your own creation. You don't understand what an incredible thing you've done.
Who was it? He asked, not so sure that his voice would sound as distinct as hers. Who was it, Martha?
A young one, she told him. He could hear the contrived relish in her voice, or was it contrived? Succulent and tender. You've no idea how fresh they are when they're in that condition, like a breath of cool wind in your soul. It's hot down here, isn't it, Paul? Did you think you needed the heat to soothe your poor arthritic bones? Can't you stand the chill of winter anymore?
The sheriff was here, he told her. He's a good man. One incident won't mean anything, but if you don't move on, he'll know that something's crazily wrong. He'll come after you, Martha. You don't know what it's like down here, how fiercely they resist the things that are done to them day by cruel circumstances.
Did you tell him? She jeered. Did you tell him what the screen was? Did you tell him who I am?
He couldn't reply immediately. He couldn't say no. She waited for him, probably, knowing exactly how he was going to cop out. I will, he said. I'll tell him everything. Tomorrow, I'll tell him everything.
It's too late for that, she said. You should have done that 13 years ago, if you were ever going to. Instead, you chose to hide. You chose to hide me, and you chose to hide from me. Will you tell them now to shoot me down like a mad dog? Will you tell them now that I can't be taken into custody, can't be tried, can't be jailed? Will you tell them to crush me underfoot like some poisonous insect? You've had 13 years to do that, doctor, and you've held your tongue.
I won't let you come here, he said. This is my home, and I won't have you violate it. This is where it stops, Martha. This is where I draw the line. I'm going to tell him, Martha. Go now, and don't ever come back this way again.
I don't believe you, she said. If you're so concerned about this precious little community, pack your things. We'll go on together, any place you fancy. I'm tired of being alone, Paul. I need you. I want you. And if you don't want to come with me, I might just have to kill you. It's the nature of the beast, Dr. Scrivener. The nature of the beast which you made. I'm your creation, Paul. I'm the only thing you have to leave to posterity. You shouldn't have run from me. I never ran away. I never run away from what I am.
The moment she put the phone down, he began to wish that he'd hung up on her. He'd let her run the whole conversation. He'd let her decide the beginning and its end. He'd displayed his impotence yet again, and in so doing had conceded that everything she said of him was true. He knew that he ought to tell Jim Alvey everything. He knew that he'd always known that, the true reason he'd courted the man's acquaintance and made a friend of him had nothing to do with the love of a stupid game, and everything to do with the knowledge that he would one day need a confessor. And yet, in all the years he'd known the sheriff, through all the long, sweltering evenings when they sat outside, he'd never said a word about his reasons for coming way down south or about the project he'd left behind. Time after time he'd hesitated over it and left it all unsaid. Maybe he'd left it too long. He'd certainly left it long enough to let death into his adopted community, just as he'd let it into the community where he'd lived most of his working life. He wished that he could just pick up the phone and call Jim or Roy or the station house or anyone at all, but he couldn't. He was still a coward, still a runaway, still a man who couldn't draw the line and stick to it. He was impotent in more ways than one. He wouldn't believe me, he thought, and knew that it was true. Alvey couldn't believe him right away. Alvey would check back and make sure and weigh things up and down and sideways. In the end, he would probably believe, but not until there'd been more deaths, maybe many more. By the time Alvey could be convinced, hell would have broken loose, and he, Paul Scrivener, would be well and truly in it, burning in the fires of universal hatred. But there was only one alternative to picking up the phone, and that required a different kind of bravery, which he wasn't sure he had. The next evening, as dusk was fading, Alve mounted the steps to the veranda where Scrivener sat, dispirited to the point of exhaustion. The lamp was already lit in anticipation of another long and sweaty evening. "Long day?" Scrivener asked when the ritual exchange of greetings was complete. He couldn't bring himself to ask outright about the body. "Yeah," said Alve, pausing before lowering himself into the chair that was permanently set out for him. "Look, Doc, I need some advice. You're the only person I can come to." Alarm made Scrivener tense up inside, but he was sure that he wasn't showing any signs. "Why me?" he asked. "It's about what we heard last night," said Alve, finally setting his lean frame into the chair. "Half a dozen other people down the hill say they heard it, but they were maybe twice as far away from it as we were. I talked to the Riddicks and Old Man Johnson, and they all said that it sounded like some animal hollering. I'm probably the only person in town that thinks something's not right. Even the kid's ma closed up about it. She lost her husband and one of her daughters in the war. She's learned too well how to take it. There's no rage left in her, no sense of atrocity." "Atrocity?" Scrivener repeated uneasily. "Sorry, Doc. Not that kind of atrocity. Fact is, the boy didn't have a mark on him. No sign of violence whatsoever. The medical examiner went over him with a fine-tooth comb and couldn't find a thing. Only thing he could put on the register was heart failure. He told me it wasn't really a cause, just a statement. He didn't have any explanation at all. No suspicious circumstances, no evidence of any crime. It's like he just dropped dead, except that you and I, Doc, know that he didn't just drop dead. You and I heard him scream." "What kind of advice do you want, Jim?" asked Scrivener carefully. Alve paused for a moment before replying, and his gaze wandered over the jungle weed that was spilling over Scrivener's fences, springing up all over the place. Then he looked back at his companion, and a sheriff's gaze was steady and penetrating. "If I'd been on my own when I heard it," he said, "I guess I'd be doubting my memory by now. You can't really remember a sound, can you, Doc? Not if you only hear it once, for a short space. It's not as if a scream were music, is it? You have no clues to help you reconstruct it. But when I heard that scream, Doc, I looked up, and what I looked at was you. I saw you hear it. And I know that what you heard was just as shocking to you as it was to me. I can't make the scream sound again in my head, but I can picture your face. And I know that what we heard was something real, something awful. I read it in your eyes, and that's what keeps me from doubting myself. So I know that you'll understand me when I say that only you and I know that there's something here that has to be figured out. I know that you'll understand me when I say that you're the one person I can trust to take my question seriously. The ME couldn't, you see. He just shrugged it off." "What question?" Scrivener asked, forcing the words out of a mouth that had suddenly gone dry. "The question that's nagging me. You see, I know that what you and I heard last night was a cry of pain, the cry of a man in absolute agony. And yet the body my men found this morning hasn't a mark on it. Hell, there isn't even a bruise from where the poor kid fell over. It's like he was just switched off. So what I want to know, Doc, and what I'd like to ask your advice about is this. What kind of pain can a boy have to make him scream like that and kill him stone dead without leaving any sign at all on his body? I know you don't know, Doc, so don't bother to tell me that, but I also know that you're a scientist who's worked in human biology and a pretty smart guy all around. Give me some ideas, Doc, some possibilities." The sheriff's eyes were frank and friendly. He really was asking for help from the one man who might understand him. He didn't suspect a thing. Scrivener was ashamed to find the anxiety easing out of him. There was no proof of crime, no shadow of suspicion to darken his doorstep. Jim Alvey just wanted to talk, to express his unease. In that, he was exceptional. 95 million people had died within the borders of the USA during these last 30 years, and that was in a nation that had escaped relatively lightly. The boy's mother was the one who had the right attitude. People surrounded for such a long period by so much death couldn't afford to let grief prick them into demanding explanations and excuses. Death simply was. It was everywhere. Martha left no trail of horror where she went, nor any pattern that would show up on a police computer. All the death certificates said heart failure. What else could they say? "Take your time, Doc," Alvey added, calling Scrivener's attention to the fact that he had made no attempt to reply. The scientist looked into the sheriff's eyes and saw nothing there but patience. Alvey thought that he was thinking about it and wasn't trying to rush him. "I could tell him now," Scrivener thought. "I could offer him the whole thing on a plate, couched as a hypothesis, without accusing myself, without even implicating myself. I could lay it out for him, but what good would it do? The only way I can give him enough to justify shooting her down on sight would be to tell him everything. And even then, he's too decent a man. If he goes after her, she'll surely kill him. I can handle it myself. I can make her go away. That's all that's needed, and all that can be done without more lives being lost. I just have to make her go away." "Maybe the boy suffered some kind of fit," he said, although the hypocrisy tasted like ashes in his mouth. "Maybe the internal spasm which stopped his heart caused him great pain, something like angina, but worse. Even after your heart stops, you still have oxygen in your brain for a little while. Enough to let you feel, maybe enough to let you scream." "People with heart attacks gasp," said Alvey. "They don't scream. They get short of breath as if their lungs won't pump. In my experience, that is. Do you know different?" "Not all attacks are alike," said Scrivener weakly. "Maybe the heart, maybe the brain. I know he didn't have a stroke, or the ME would have found a clot or evidence of the hemorrhage, but maybe something more like an epileptic fit, an electrical event that left his motor nerves free to operate long enough to produce the scream." Silently, though, he said, "You already know the answers, Jim. You spoke the words yourself. Absolute agony, pure pain, and nothing else. No further cause in the poor kid's body." "Could it be something we haven't seen before?" asked Alvey, not pushily, but as if he were groping for support. "Something the ME didn't know to look for? Could it be something left over from the last war, or the first shot in the next? Could it be something cooked up in a lab, Doc? I know you've been out of the work for a while, but you'd know if something like that would be possible, wouldn't you?" "Everything's possible, Jim," said Scrivener softly. "Anything and everything that could kill or maim a man can come out of today's labs. Maybe the plague war isn't over, but if that's what it is, what can you or I do about it?" Alvey didn't answer that for a moment or two. Then he stood up, replaced his hat, brushed his pants, and said, "I just wanted you to think about it, Doc. I still do. I want you to turn it over in your mind and see if anything strikes you. I really would appreciate your advice, if you can think of any to offer. I don't know what we can do, but I wouldn't feel right if I just let this thing pass without trying to figure it out, even if it ain't really my business, because there ain't really any crime. I'm not that kind of guy." "I know," said Scrivener softly, wishing that he weren't that kind of guy himself. He watched the sheriff walk away, and then he settled back into his own chair, waiting for the phone to ring. The phone never did ring, and the sleepless night finally caught up with Scrivener. He nodded off in the chair, and when he finally caught himself up with a start and opened his eyes, she was there, sitting in the sheriff's chair. He knew that she had taken up that position so that the table could be between them. She still had some talking to do.
You didn't tell him, did you?
She said. No, he admitted.
I knew you wouldn't. He'd never understand, would he? The best you could hope for is that he'd act without understanding, and that's not what you want deep down. You don't want them to shoot me down. Not because you love me. You're not man enough for that. Not even because you made me. Because I'm your one and only Eve. It's just that you'd have to face them then. You'd have to stand before them and face the force of their uncomprehending hatred, the malice born of their stupid incapacity to understand. You can't stand the idea that they'd think of you as a fool, one more of the reckless madmen who brought the human race to the edge of annihilation.
What do you want, Martha? He demanded. Why did you come here? Not surely because you love me. You surely gave that up a long time ago.
You underestimate the durability of female love, she said mockingly. It's only natural that those who allow doctors to exercise godlike powers over them should fall in love with their recreators, isn't it? The sexual success of cosmetic engineers is legendary. And what you tried to do? You tried to do for the sakes of love, didn't you? For the enhancement of human understanding. You wanted to move beyond good and evil. And you succeeded.
She was deliberately twisting words he had used. She knew exactly what he had meant when he had spoken of moving beyond good and evil. That had always been his aim. In the past, men had decided what was evil. Hunger, thirst, pain, fear, sickness, misery. And had formed their notion of good negativity as the relief or repair of evils. Almost all of the non-military applications of biotechnology had been directed toward that kind of good. The relief of hunger, the healing of disease, the alleviation of peril. He had wanted to go beyond that kind of corrective philosophy in search of some notion of positive creative good. His ambition had been to improve the quality of human life, to transcend the legacy of the natural, to add to human powers of communication, understanding, and love. Everything she said was true, even though she was mocking him. Her very existence and the killing habit which she claimed as her nature was the greatest mockery of all. What do you want, Martha? He said again.
I want you to be with me, she said simply. I'm lonely. You have no idea how lonely I am. I need you, Paul. That's all there is to it.
He looked into her eyes, as he had earlier looked into Alve's. The lamp above the table cast its light at the familiar angle, throwing unkind shadows across her lined face. She was still handsome after a fashion, but age had made its indelible mark. Why couldn't fate have decided that she'd be counted among the casualties of the long war? Why had she survived when so many innocents had perished? Why had he? How many people have you killed, Martha? He asked.
I don't keep count, she said flatly.
You don't have to do it. You're a human being, a moral being. You have a choice.
What the hell do you know about it? She demanded. You don't know. You can't know. Do you think a junkie has any real choice about grabbing his next fix? Do you think a torture victim has any real choice about answering questions? And that's just crude conditioning. Answer or else. That's just pain as blunt instrument. What happens inside me is right inside the brain, Paul. It's the addiction circuit itself that's activated by direct stimulation. Even those rats with electrodes pouring shocks into their pleasure centers were just beating themselves over the head with rough-hewn bricks compared to the precision and purity of what you gave me. You have no idea what good really means, Dr. Scrivener. For all your talk about accentuating the positive and eliminating the negative, you have no idea what pleasure is pure, unadulterated, perfect pleasure. Should I? Sure, I have a choice, Dr. Scrivener. It's the fact that I have a choice which makes me choose pleasure, because I'm the only human being on the surface of the planet who can
choose pleasure. Nobody who had the choice could ever choose anything different, because that's what choice is, the chance to go for the best, the chance to grab what's really worth having. And even then, he said, when it was clear that she had finished, it's not enough. Even though you have what you have, you want something more. Yes, she answered flatly. I want more. I want sympathy. I want love. Ordinary, everyday companionship. Even though I have the other thing, I still have to live in the world. I'm not a monster, Paul. I'm a human being, as you keep reminding me. I'm a human being. Why me? He asked hollowly. It was a stupid question. Because you're the only one who understands, she said, her voice halfway between innocence and bleakness. You're the only one who understands who I am. Nobody else ever has or ever could. When I tried to explain, even to the special ones, I had to kill them, Paul. I had to. And if I won't be understanding, he said, you've decided to kill me too, haven't you? I wouldn't really do that, she told him, although the lie was quite transparent. I'd never harm you, but you have to come with me. You have to. I can't go on without you. And I can't go on at all, he thought miserably. I don't know why I ever thought I could, even if you disappeared the way I wanted you to, even if you died the way you ought to have done. How could I just go on? He reached across the table with both arms, palms forward, and fingers splayed. All right, Martha, he said quietly. Let's see how much choice you have. She rose to the challenge nobly. She folded her fingers around his, and their palms touched face to face. They looked into one another's lamplit eyes, and she really wasn't going to make a move. She really was opening out to him, offering her heart. She really was as lonely as that. Her scream echoed in his ears for a little longer than the couple of seconds it lasted, but it died away. As Jim Alvey had observed, it wasn't easy to remember sounds of that outlandish character. The human mind simply wasn't equipped for imagining such things. But the sight of her astonished eyes lingered much, much longer. The visual imagination is so much more apt than the auditory, so much more responsive to facial expressions. He tried to figure out what he felt, but it wasn't easy. It was all so unexpected. For the moment, it was pure sensation, which might be negotiated into joy or exultation or horror, maybe even terror. He could still see her face when he finally realized that he was not alone and that Sheriff Alvey had already drawn his gun. Where were you? Scrivener asked. Right out there in the jungle weeds, said Alvey. I saw the woman headed up this way and followed her. You had a hunch, said Scrivener, wondering why he was being sarcastic. I had a little more than a hunch, said Alvey, but not enough. I wish I'd had more. I wish you'd stayed away until you'd thought it over. Tomorrow you'd have told me everything I wanted to know, wouldn't you? There isn't a mark on her, Scrivener pointed out. Even though you saw us, even though you heard her scream, you have no evidence that any crime has been committed. All that happened was that we held hands for a few moments, and then she dropped dead. Even if everyone were to accept that she screamed in pain, that wouldn't prove a thing. As I suggested to you earlier, the only explanation anybody could accept is that she had some kind of electrical storm in her brain, some kind of fit. There's nothing suspicious about my being on the scene, given that I have the perfect alibi for the moment of the other death. Anyway, what do you have that's more than a hunch? I looked at you right after we heard the other scream, said the sheriff. What I saw in your face then, it wasn't just shock, it was recognition. You weren't puzzled, Doc. The moment you heard that sound, even though it was like nothing on earth, you knew what it was. You'd heard it before. That's not evidence, said Scrivener dismissively. If you took that into any court of law in the land, you'd be laughed right out of it. I know that, said Alvey, whose own expression still looked strangely amiable. His big dark eyes seemed as frank and guileless as they always had. That's why I figured I had to take it slowly, step by step. I kind of figured on worming it out of you by stealthy persuasion. I think you'd have been ready to trust me with the story given time. Pity the lady was in such a hurry. She did kill the boy, I suppose. Scrivener nodded mechanically. Alvey still had his gun in his hand, and he was still standing up. Not that there was anywhere for him to sit down, given that there was a body in his chair. "Did you hear what we were saying?" asked the doctor. "Most of it," said Alvey, "but I have to say that I couldn't make much sense out of what I heard. I already knew she'd done it a lot more times, even though none of it showed up on the police computer." "What did you check out? Medical records?" Alvey shook his head. "Too much ordinary heart failure to show up the pattern. I had to check with the State University. Did you know that the archivist there has programs which sort and store data from every newspaper in the world? Hell of a thing. Awesome amounts of information and all cross-correlated, if you only know what to ask for. Nobody had ever asked before, but it was in there right enough. Screams in the night usually get reported somewhere around the bottom of page 5, even in local papers, and they only get promoted to page 2 if someone links them to a mysterious death, just so long as there's no evidence of a crime. But they do get reported. Enough, anyhow, I was able to confirm that our little incident was by no means the only one, and that the first ones on record happened up in Canada, in Toronto. You worked up in Toronto, didn't you, Doc? You were there when the whole thing started, weren't you? You knew this when you came to see me this evening? Asked Scrivener. Alvey nodded. Stealthy persuasion, the doctor quoted. You surely have a flair for the key phrase, Jim. Stealthy persuasion, absolute agony. I'm not sure we have time for stealthy persuasion any longer, said the sheriff. I'm asking you right out, Doc. What the hell is going on here? I know I just saw you commit a murder, but I still can't figure out how or why. Aren't you supposed to read me my rights so that whatever I say can be used against me? Don't you get into procedural difficulties when you come to court if you don't do that? I'm asking you as one friend to another, Doc. I just want to know what's happening here just now. I'm not thinking about making it a case. For 13 years, Scrivener had found himself unable to speak. Now, with Martha lying there, stone dead, he found at least that it was impossible to remain silent. It was an experiment, he said. Have you ever wondered what it might be like, really, to get in contact with someone else? To be able to share your feelings, maybe even your thoughts? I guess, said Alvey. You mean telepathy? Something like that? Telepathy's just the plausible impossibility, said Scrivener, because we hear our own thoughts, as if they were words spoken in the private spaces of our mind. It seems plausible that someone else might be able to listen in, but it isn't like that, really, without an actual connection of some kind, a physical connection. There's no way that the information can get across. Even radio waves need a transmitter and a receiver adapted to their task. But we have technologies now which seem to me to offer the chance of making such a connection. We have ways of persuading damaged nerve tissue to regenerate, and it only requires a change of perspective to turn those techniques to the further purpose of making our nervous systems more elaborate. I operated on Martha's left hand, restructuring the superficial tissue so that her nerve cells could extend filaments through the epidermis, and then through the epidermis of any hand that was touching hers, to link up with the nerves in the other hand. I gave her the ability to form an actual multi-synaptic interface between her nervous system and that of another person. I didn't expect miracles to follow the formation of such a bridge, of course, but once it was in place, I thought there was a chance that the two people so linked might be able to train themselves up to find some way of exchanging information. I thought that there might be a possibility of making the bridge functional, of actually transferring experience of some kind directly from one system to the other. I assumed that in the beginning it would be very primitive sensations, but that in the fullness of time, Martha and the passive volunteers might cultivate new facilities and new aptitudes. I asked them to try hard for any possible effect, just to make sure the cross-simulation was possible. Maybe I should have stopped when the early results were all to do with pain, but I didn't. I thought, hoped, at least, that the pain was just teething troubles, that we'd get past it. Instead, well, maybe this trick that Martha learned wasn't the only one there was to be learned. Maybe it was just a fluke of ill fortune. On the other hand, maybe there's a very good reason why natural selection didn't give us nerves, which could extend themselves to that kind of communication. All that Martha learned was how to increase the pain sensation and restrict them to the passive partner. And while she learned it, she was also hooking her new skills up to certain circuits in her hindbrain, the circuits which generate the physical rewards that we construe as pleasure. By the time I cut off the eye experiments in the lab, it was already too late. She was conducting experiments of her own. When she called me to report her results, I knew how badly it had all gone wrong. I was scared and bitterly disappointed. I should have stayed, revealed my hideous failure to the world, faced the music. But I didn't. I quit. I retired. I came down here. Martha had already disappeared, having discovered that the greatest pleasure of all, the purest pleasure that life has to offer, her life at any rate, is that to be obtained by linking up one nervous system to another and flooding the passive system with pure pain. Absolute agony is absolutely right, Jim. That's what does it. What it must feel like to the victim, you can't possibly imagine. All the pain you've ever felt is a localized response to injury. What Martha could do went way beyond that. Way beyond. They died of it. Shock, followed by brain death. Heart failure is secondary, I think, an effect rather than a cause. The only symptom is the scream. For Martha, that self-same shock of connection was pure pleasure. Again, you can't really imagine that, Jim, because all the pleasure you've ever felt is moderated, muffled, half-hearted. No matter how intense it seemed, Martha was the ultimate sadist, Jim. Her infinite pleasure was the infinite pain of her victims. Maybe it could have been different. Maybe someone else, using exactly the same physiological apparatus, could have become something infinitely better. But how could we possibly dare to try, knowing that the risk was there of creating another Martha, perhaps hundreds of Marthas? How could we ever dare to make connections, knowing what that might lead to? How did she come to be the volunteer, Dr. Scrivener asked Alvey quietly. How did you choose her? She was my wife, said Scrivener. She'd been my lab assistant for years, but by the time I performed the operation, she was my wife. Who operated on you, Doc? He asked. Who gave you the power? Scrivener was mildly surprised by that one. When I say operation, he said, I'm not talking about scalpels. It was all quite bloodless and painless. I didn't need anybody else. I did the operation myself after Martha walked out. But before I found out what extremes she'd gone to on her own behalf, I had to stop my own investigations after that, you see, because of everything I said just now. How could I carry on knowing what a risk there was? I daren't use what I'd given myself in case I became like her. But you were strong enough to kill her, Alvey pointed out. When it came to a contest, you won. That wasn't a contest, Scrivener told him. I took her by surprise. She wasn't expecting it. She only wanted to hold my hand. I wasn't even sure that I could do it. I only knew I had to try. Alvey's gaze flicked back to the dead woman. Scrivener followed the direction of the sheriff's stare. Martha looked so very peaceful. Not at all the way someone who had died of absolute agony ought to look. What now, Jim? Said Scrivener. Are you going to shoot me down like a rabid dog? Maybe you want me to write it all down first so you can show it to the tribunal when you have to explain it? I don't think that'll be necessary, said the sheriff. All I want is that you should tell your story. It isn't up to me whether you're charged with murder or anything else. I just want the facts on record so that the proper authorities can make up their minds.
That's very big of you, Jim, said Scrivener, but I'll bet you're not willing to put that gun back in its holsters and shake me by the hand now that you know I'm a monster. You'll never trust me again, nor will anyone else. From now on, I've lost my place, not just in Romilly, but in the whole human world.
No, Doc, said Alvey calmly, it ain't like that. I spend a lot of time sitting here with you, talking and playing chess and all. The folk down the hill still call you an outsider, but you're the best friend I got. I pride myself on being a good judge of character, and I still believe you'd have told me everything, given a little stealthy coaxing. I'll put my gun away now, and we can walk down the hill together just like we have a dozen times before.
Thanks, Jim, said the doctor sincerely. You're right, of course. I'm still a human being. I can make my own choices. A full 20 minutes had passed before the sheriff's scream rent the air. He was a big man, and he had big lungs. He could be heard halfway across the county, but even the people who were pretty close eventually persuaded themselves that it was just some kind of animal hollering. These days, they told themselves, what with the damn scientists throwing evolution into a higher gear in the desperate attempt to stop the world going to hell in a handbasket, you never could tell what would turn up next. When they found Jim Alvey's body the next morning, they naturally fell to wondering all over again. But when they'd talked it out among themselves, there was nothing much to be done. After all, the guy hadn't a mark on him. And even though he was the sheriff, he hadn't had an enemy in the world.